are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, criminal arrest warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, more charges and warrants in the pipeline, and a conversation with Francesca Albanese about U.S.-Israeli crimes and impunity. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Criminal kingpins defend themselves, cross them, you are dead. White Rose activists resisting the Nazis, Italian journalists and prosecutors pursuing the mafia, dissident Russian politicians challenging Vladimir Putin and getting too popular, guillotined, gunned down, poisoned, or starved to death in a gulag jail. Now, condemning the U.S. government and its foreign policies or pursuing its partner in crime in court probably won't get you killed. Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, will just ruin your life. Ask Andrew Cayley. Together with American lawyer Brenda Hollis, Cayley, a British barrister, steered the International Criminal Court investigation leading to arrest warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu and his war minister Yoav Gallant back in November 2024. Quote, "It was the worst few months of my life," Cayley told The Observer. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham screamed and yelled at him, vowing sanctions against Cayley and the court. Phone threats followed. Then, the kicker, "Watch your back," Dutch police warned Cayley. Quote, "They said we need to look at your flat, and we need to put alarms on all the French windows, bars across the skylights, and you need a reinforced bulletproof door," Cayley recounted to The Observer. Last fall, Cayley quit. Others have, too. ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan and four judges are now under U.S. sanction. Bank accounts frozen, email accounts blocked. The court's IT system, its very existence, is under existential threat. Meanwhile, Benjamin Netanyahu travels back and forth between Tel Aviv and Washington through European airspace, fearing nothing from Greek, Italian, French, or British authorities. With me to talk about the ICC arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant, where they stand, other warrants that may be issued against other Israeli leaders, and crippling U.S. sanctions against the ICC is Toby Cadman. Cadman is an international human rights lawyer and the co-founder and joint head of Guernica 37 Chambers, a London-based law firm specializing in international criminal and humanitarian law. Toby, 8 months after the issuance of these arrest warrants by the ICC, I'm wondering what impact they've had on the situation and if they've had any kind of measurable impact on Israel's impunity in this regard. And some suggest that the arrest warrants haven't really had any impact. Can you comment?
Well, regrettably, they haven't had the impact for which they were issued, of course. When warrants such as this are issued, first of all, you want to ensure that those individuals who are subject to international arrest warrants are handed over to the court, to the international court. That obviously hasn't succeeded. And of course, the secondary purpose when these investigations such as this are initiated is to try to bring an end to crimes being committed. And of course, as we've seen, the crimes continue. So it hasn't achieved what it was set out to achieve. Of course, there were arrest warrants for both Israeli officials and for officials from Hamas. And the case against Hamas was obviously is now pretty much at an end because the accused who were subject to the arrest warrants have all been killed. So so I think on either side, it hasn't achieved what it was set out to achieve, regrettably, and the conflict continues unabated.
Now, where do the arrest warrants stand at this moment, Toby? There has been activity at the ICC, although it's really not been reported on. It's kind of international legal weeds. Israel has been challenging the arrest warrants under Articles 18 and 19 of the Rome Statute, and its challenges have gone through the pre-trial chamber and then up to the appeals chamber, and then it's now back at the pre-trial chamber, all turning around Articles 18 and 19 of the Rome Statute. Without getting too deep into the weeds, can you explain what these two challenges are?
Of course, what we've seen is the challenge to the jurisdiction, the challenge as to the basis that the warrants were issued. And of course, those challenges are ongoing. They haven't been brought to an end. Of course, until such time as those warrants are overruled or withdrawn, then they are still valid arrest warrants. But of course, what we have seen is the steps being taken by the Trump administration in effectively sanctioning the court and sanctioning key members. We've learned that one of the senior prosecutors who was responsible for the Palestine situation had to resign because of that situation with the sanctions. And what many people are talking about is the sanctions and the lack of cooperation from other states is really creating an existential threat to the ICC and where it goes from here. And of course, that is deeply disturbing. But of course, we still want to see those who are subject to international arrest warrants being brought before the court and facing justice. It is, of course, concerning when we have one of the lead suspects in that case traveling now for the second or third time to the United States to meet with the US president. And we've also had other states, European states, that have said that if Netanyahu or the former defense minister were to enter their territory, then they wouldn't arrest. And because the whole system of the ICC is built on state party cooperation, it really does undermine the central purpose for the first permanent international criminal court.
But now, getting back to these two challenges, I mean, Article 18, Israel says that the court should have given it, the prosecutor should have issued it a brand new notification, right? Because October 7th was the beginning of history. And so what happened before October 7th, which was the basis of the original notification by Fatou Bensouda, who was prosecutor at the time, that Israel basically ignored, didn't respond to. But the whole situation's changed. So they're saying that under Article 18, the court, the prosecutor has to issue brand new notification so that Israel can say, we're looking into this. And Article 19 is the jurisdiction, principally turning around Israel's argument that the Oslo Accords trump the Rome Statute and that Palestine isn't a state. I mean, I find these interesting arguments, but I mean, I'm interested in international criminal law and the Rome Statute. But do these arguments, do you think these arguments hold water? And are they really relevant? Are these arguments that people who are observing the court who are non-experts should be interested in?
Well, looking at a purely legalistic response to that, no, I don't think that those challenges hold water. I don't think that the prosecutor was required to make a new notification. The prosecutor, Karim Khan, at the time was perfectly entitled to proceed on the basis of the prior ruling that had been made under Fatou Bensouda's term of office. So no, I don't think that that is an argument that holds water at all. And secondly, the jurisdictional challenge, well, like it or not, Palestine is a state. It is a state party to the Rome Statute. It had reversed the situation to the ICC, and so the court very clearly has jurisdiction. We were one of several groups that had provided an amicus brief in relation to the jurisdictional question, where we effectively said that no, the Oslo Accords do not trump the Rome Statute. Palestine is a state party, and it is perfectly entitled to refer the situation, and the prosecutor is perfectly entitled jurisdictionally to launch an investigation. We go back to this repeated argument that, frankly, I think is fundamentally flawed, in that the ICC cannot exercise jurisdiction over a non-state party. Well, it can when the crimes that are being committed either by citizens of the state, which is a state party, or on the territory of that state party. So both in terms of the 7th of October attacks that were committed by Palestinian nationals, the ICC has jurisdiction over that. And of course, the subsequent attacks on Gaza and more recently in the West Bank are on Palestinian territory that the ICC has accepted is Palestinian territory. And so there is jurisdiction for that. And regardless of how the court rules now, it has previously ruled in the Myanmar-Bangladesh case, in particular, where crimes occur. In the Myanmar situation, it was in relation to forced deportation of Rohingya from Myanmar, a non-state party, into Bangladesh, which was a state party. So part of the crime had occurred on the territory of a state party. So there is a clear basis for establishing jurisdiction. And of course, those impacted by these cases can effectively bring challenges to suggest that these fall within the jurisdiction of the Israeli courts. And as we repeatedly hear, that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East and it has a functional judicial system. Well, it's had plenty of opportunity to investigate crimes committed by Israeli Defense Forces in Palestine, and it has failed to do so. And of course, there is always the situation where we know that the ICC is a court of last resort, and it's only if the state is unwilling or unable to prosecute those matters domestically, then the ICC can only then exercise jurisdiction. But what we're talking about is the Palestinian state, because it is the Palestinian state that has the duty under the principle of complementarity to suggest that these matters should be investigated and prosecuted by Israel. And that has, in effect, breached the principle of complementarity. Again, is not an argument that I believe holds any water.
Now, the tantalizing question for me, Toby Cadman, is the pretrial chamber number one, now sitting on a request for additional charges to be issued against Netanyahu and perhaps Gallant, possibly including genocide. But there are other charges that can be laid, certainly revolving around the settlement enterprise and forced displacement. And so I'm wondering if the pretrial chamber is actually, if Khan or the other deputy prosecutors have issued a request to the pretrial chamber to add additional charges, and this is now sitting at the pretrial chamber, as well as applications for additional arrest warrants against people like Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, and the pretrial chamber is just, and this is ex parte, this is just in secret, this is confidential between the prosecutor and the pretrial chamber, and it's sitting on them and waiting to dispose of Israel's challenges before announcing, you know, we're dismissing these challenges and we're adding additional charges against Netanyahu and we're going to issue additional arrest warrants. Do you think this is likely?
Well, as you quite rightly say, that's the issuance of additional arrest warrants or the expansion of the charges is a confidential ex parte process. And so anything that I could say would be pure speculation. And so I can't answer that question.
Speculate if you can.
No, I don't speculate on these things. I mean,
because you think given, you know, everything that's passed happens over the last 8 months, it's just obviously a genocide, and obviously additional charges are warranted, and obviously there are more people who need to be charged.
And sorry to interrupt, but and obviously that's a decision that the prosecutor can make based on the evidence available to him. Now, of course, if the prosecutor, the office of the prosecutor, if they consider that there is a sufficient evidential basis, not what we know and not what we see, but whether there is a sufficient credible evidential basis for bringing additional charges, then I'm convinced that they will do that. But we will only know that in the fullness of time. And I appreciate your push to me to speculate, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to speculate on what the pretrial chamber may or may not be doing and what the prosecutor may or not be seeking. Of course, it is to be expected that the investigations that are conducted by the Office of the Prosecutor are much wider, much broader than the what is set out in those arrest warrants. But I think it's reasonable to expect that there will be additional cases, not just against Israeli officials, but potentially against Hamas and other associated groups. I think it is reasonable to expect that the case is broader than what we've seen now. But again, well, unfortunately, we're all going to have to be patient and wait until the pretrial chamber makes a decision or the prosecutor makes public that there are broader investigations. I think it's likely that there are matters that relate to the West Bank that are under consideration. That was always the certainly if you go back to Fatou Bensouda's original application and her original statement prior to Karim Khan taking office, it is very clear that what was the scope of jurisdiction is much wider than obviously what we've seen now. Now, I appreciate that that was at a time before this current attack on Gaza, but I think that there is sufficient scope for that, for those investigations to be widened. What is, I think, more interesting and more likely is what we're seeing now, just in the last 24 hours, discussions about setting up effectively an internment camp in Gaza to move, at the outset, 600,000, but potentially 2 million Gazans into an internment camp.
This is now, Israel Katz's idea. I mean, talk about somebody who should have another arrest warrant issued against them, Israel Katz.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, look.
And Israeli lawyer Michael Sfard talking about this as the quintessential crime against humanity.
Absolutely. I mean, having commented on it earlier today, I've compared that to what we saw at the Keraton and Amaska camps in Prijedor in Bosnia. And it's reminiscent of the early stages of the Srebrenica genocide. So, you know, there are parallels to draw. We don't know at this stage whether it is a government-wide policy or whether they are just testing the water to see what the reaction is to this. But it's very clear when you read his statement and look into what he's saying is that, you know, we're not talking about the voluntary relocation of Gazans. We're talking about the forcible displacement and internment in a military guarded camp where those who are supposedly moved into that camp cannot leave. So, yes, this is clear evidence if they were to put in place such a plan of ethnic cleansing. And so, as has quite rightly been stated, the quintessential crime against humanity. So, you know, I think all of those matters are within the jurisdiction of the ICC, are within what has been contemplated in investigations into the situation. And so, I think we can expect to see more. But we then go back to the core of the problem is that, well, if they issue additional arrest warrants, then to what extent is there actually going to be any meaningful accountability, meaning people were actually brought before the court. And it's all well and good issuing arrest warrants and making grand statements about these investigations, but that has to be followed with concrete action. And that's what's sadly missing.
I want to ask you what impact these U.S. government sanctions have had on the court against Karim Khan and against four judges. And there's all this stuff going on, right? Bank accounts being frozen and email accounts being frozen and the entire IT system at the ICC, right? The whole Microsoft system, they've had to switch over to another system. I like your thoughts on what impact that's having on the court and on its resolve. But a more specific question, Article 70 under the Rome Statute prohibits intimidation and threats against the court and its officers. What do you think is the likelihood that the court is going to, I don't know, what would it issue if it decides that Article 70 has been violated by the U.S. government, you know, by Donald Trump? What could it do? What could it do, and what do you think it will do?
Well, so the first question, what kind of impact has it had? It's had a devastating impact on the ICC. And I don't think it's an exaggeration when people talk about the existential threat to the ICC. This is an existential threat to the ICC, and it's an existential threat to international criminal justice as we understand it. Of course, there are many good reasons for why the International Criminal Court was established in the first place. And this goes to attack the very core of that. So I think it has had a devastating impact. It's forced individuals who were involved in the investigations to consider whether they can stay in their jobs. Some have left. I'm sure we'll see many more leaving because they are concerned as to their own security, their own financial security. And so I think that we will probably see more impact as things progress. Because it doesn't appear to me that the sanctions have deterred the court and the Office of the Prosecutor from continuing in their mandate. I think that very clearly they must continue. As far as any Article 70 charges can be brought, well, if we look at a very basic level, if we look at some of the individuals that have been charged with contempt at the ICC and at the other international tribunals, like previously the ICTY, the ICTR, and more recently the Kosovo Specialist Chambers, when you look at the conduct of those, what they're actually accused of, they pale in comparison to what could potentially be Article 70 charges brought against any individual who now brings, effectively interferes with the administration of justice. I mean, it is very clear obstruction, whether you're looking at the elements of the US government or whether you're looking at other states and their involvement in this process. I think if the ICC is to have any credibility and any real legitimacy, then it needs to address these attempts to obstruct its work.
What would it do concretely? Would it issue an arrest warrant against Marco Rubio, or what would it do?
Well, of course, that is open to the prosecutor to bring charges against an individual for any conduct which amounts to an obstruction of justice. So it would have to open an investigation. It would have to look at the statements and the acts, the conduct of the individual or the institutions of which that person is attached to, and identify whether that amounts under the statute to obstruction. And of course, it then becomes a very political decision when you're targeting somebody who may well be the Secretary of State or may well be a powerful force within a foreign government. But we would hope that it's not purely a political decision which is taken. It's a decision which is based on the law, on the rule of law, and the evidential threshold for establishing those charges. But again, going back to the point that if the ICC, if the Office of the Prosecutor does not pursue Article 70 charges against any individual for obstructing in their work, again, what credibility, what long-term legitimacy does the institution have? And I think that's one of the questions that they really have to look at very, very carefully.
There's some very critical voices on the left, and I know a few of them, who cut no slack for the ICC, who say the ICC is a complete failure. These are people on the left. It should have issued arrest warrants based on genocide. It should have charged Israel with genocide under the Rome Statute or apartheid, certainly genocide, but it didn't. And the fact that it didn't was disgraceful and continues to be disgraceful. I'm conveying the ideas of some of those individuals on the left who just, they think the ICC is a complete failure. What are your thoughts on this?
No, I don't think it's a complete failure for failing to charge genocide. I mean, what has to be understood is that genocide is the single most difficult charge to bring. And again, my personal view, and I've been quite vocal on that view, I think that that there are elements sufficient to establish genocide as far as Gaza is concerned. But again, it's a decision of a prosecutor based on the evidence which is available to him. And one of the difficulties that obviously the prosecutor has is not being able to enter Israel, not being able to enter Palestine to properly investigate. And whilst we may consider that there is a sufficient base of evidence out there to establish that charge, I think what the charges that were brought against Netanyahu and Gallant were strategically chosen based on the wealth of evidence available to them to establish those charges. But that doesn't mean that that's the, you know, the beginning and end of the case against them. I'm quite certain that the charge of genocide is something which is being actively considered by the Office of the Prosecutor. But again, it's a matter for them as to what charges they bring. I don't consider that you can say the ICC is a failure because they failed to bring a charge of genocide, even though it's quite clear, and many international scholars have said it's quite clear on an evidential basis as to what could be proven based on the available evidence. We've seen the very powerful submissions that came in the International Court of Justice case. And again, we have to be slightly careful when we talk about what the ICJ has actually ruled, because at this stage, we've only heard argument and seen the rulings on provisional measures, not on definitively establishing that Israel is in breach of its obligations under the Genocide Convention. I think ultimately they will be, and I think the ICJ will ultimately rule in favour of the claim against Israel. But we also have to be slightly careful as to how we determine what has been ruled so far. But again, that doesn't prevent the ICC and the Office of the Prosecutor from pursuing those charges. But again, go back to if we look at as I often do, if we draw a comparison with Bosnia, the ICC was only able to establish genocide over Srebrenica, wasn't able to establish genocide over different parts of Bosnia. That was heavily criticized, particularly the situation in Prijedor and in parts of eastern Bosnia. But because it is very, very difficult to establish a charge a charge of genocide. And so quite often what we see is cases being brought on, whether it's ethnic cleansing, whether it's forced deportation, as crimes against humanity. And so, again, it's at the discretion of the prosecutor as to what charges he brings. But I'd also say, look, I mean, we can't look at these things, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again, is you can't look at things on a sliding scale of gravity, because the fact that you don't charge genocide and you only charge crimes against humanity doesn't necessarily mean that you're undermining or rendering insignificant those charges. They are still very, very serious charges, whether it's war crimes, crimes against humanity. Of course, genocide is often considered as the crime of crimes. And we, looking at it from the outside, we want to see perpetrators convicted for the most serious charges, for the most serious conduct. But again, just going back, I don't think that you can just sit there and say that it's a failure because they haven't charged genocide thus far.
Last question, Toby Cadman, thank you so much for your time. Benjamin Netanyahu just returning from his second trip to Washington since these arrest warrants were issued, flying from Israel to Washington, apparently following kind of an erratic course through airspace where he thinks himself to be safe. But should Benjamin Netanyahu feel safe flying on his plane through European airspace, through Italian or French or British airspace?